You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of March, 2014, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
So many people have suffered for so long. I will not let peace be snatched from my people again. Not now, when we have already undertaken the most difficult and most significant steps to achieve it.
Alessio Patilano and Kathleen Burke will discuss the day's key news stories, including the long-awaited peace deal the Philippines has signed with the country's biggest Muslim rebel group. Then we'll speak to the Finnish director Petri Lukainen. In his documentary My Stuff, he gets rid of all of his possessions and then allows himself to get them back one by one.
Would you like look into the mirror and say like, yeah, I am my stuff. Why have I been interested in building myself or building my life from these items that I own? Like, and maybe have I been missing something else?
We'll also speak to our correspondent in Brussels and we'll get the latest book recommendations from France. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. Lots coming up then in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
The latest satellite imagery from the southern Indian Ocean suggests that up to 300 objects are floating in the waters where it's thought the missing Malaysia Airways plane was lost. The air operation searching the ocean had to be suspended earlier because of bad weather, but a number of ships have continued looking for debris. Jeffrey Thomas, the editor of the Airline Ratings website, says there's no doubt what they're looking for.
Clearly, this is aircraft wreckage. You don't get 122 objects floating in the water. I know we've got a lot of debris in the ocean, unfortunately, but not 122 objects. Some of those objects, 23 metres, 15 metres, 10 metres, they're all large pieces, plus a lot of smaller pieces as well.
After 13 years of negotiations, the government in the Philippines has signed an agreement with the country's largest Muslim rebel group. It's thought more than 120,000 people have died in more than four decades of fighting, linked to demands for independence of the southern Philippines. The Moro Islamic Liberation Front has agreed to end violence in return for autonomy for the region. The agreement was brokered by the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak, who was at the signing ceremony.
In signing this agreement, the two sides have looked not to the problems of the past, but to the promise of the future.
The International Monetary Fund has agreed to lend Ukraine up to $18 billion. It's part of a total package worth $27 billion. Meanwhile, Ukraine's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has confirmed that she will stand for president in elections in May. She was released from prison in February after being convicted of corruption under the former president, Viktor Yanukovych. Meanwhile, Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper has said that Russia cannot expect relations with other countries to improve until it changes course in Ukraine.
I don't see any way of a return of Mr. Putin to the table unless Russia fundamentally changes course on its orientation towards the world and its values and behavior, the values and behaviors of that regime towards the world.
Rescue workers in the U.S. state of Washington say the number of deaths after a devastating landslide will increase substantially. 24 people are confirmed dead after the mudslide hit the town of Oso, 55 miles north of Seattle. But 90 more are still missing. Workers are using helicopters, laser imaging, and specially trained dogs in the search operation. Authorities in Turkey have moved to block access to the YouTube website the day after a court ordered an end to a ban on Twitter. It was imposed by the Prime Minister, Tayyip Erdogan, who accuses his critics of spreading misinformation online. The YouTube ban came after what appeared to be a leaked recording of Turkish officials appeared on the site. The human rights group Amnesty International says Iraq and Iran are primarily responsible for a rise in the number of people executed around the world. It recorded a rise of almost 15% in 2013 compared to the previous year. It's thought China executed more than 1,000 people last year, but official figures are kept secret. Audrey Gochran, who's the director of global issues at Amnesty, says it's a cause for significant concern.
Almost 100 more people were put to death in 2013 compared to 2012. The countries responsible for that sharp spike are largely Iran and Iraq. Four countries also resumed executions during 2013, which was quite troubling. But that said, the overall picture, the long-term picture in terms of abolition of the death penalty is positive. And if we look back over 10, 20 years, we see a steady decline in the use of the death penalty.
A new head for Egypt's armed forces has been sworn in. General Zedki Sobhi had been appointed the day after his predecessor, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, resigned so he could stand for president. Mr. Sisi was reportedly at the cabinet meeting where his successor was chosen. He is widely expected to win the election, ordered after the military deposed Mohamed Morsi last year. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed. Paul will be back in another 25 minutes to give us another roundup of the news. But you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London now is 18:06, and that means it's 14:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Alessio Patilano, who's Professor of War Studies at King's College London, and also Kathleen Burke, who's Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. Welcome both to the show, but let's start with the latest news from the Philippines. After years of negotiations, the Philippine government has signed a peace deal with the country's biggest Muslim rebel group. This is a significant achievement for President Benigno Aquino. The deal brings to an end one of Asia's longest and deadliest conflicts. Thousands have been killed in the fighting in the south of the country. Let's start with you, Alessio. This has gone on for 40 years. And I guess what's interesting is, you know, obviously a country which has a huge Christian population and a Muslim population. And it's interesting they've managed to get a peace deal here. Do you think it offers something of a guidance for other countries around the region? Because Thailand has a similar kind of situation where they have Muslim rebels in the south. And other countries around the region, you know, seem to be torn between their Christian populations or their Hindu populations and their Muslim populations. How important for other nations around the region do you think this is?
Well, in general, this is a very important signal that actually these type of deals can happen. So in that respect, it's got a strong element of symbolism to it. So yeah, it kind of flags a possible direction. That being said, the extent to which you can actually take this case and apply it somewhere else, it's a different story altogether. The very important point here to make is that the Philippines' geography is relatively unique in this respect. You know, as a country that is composed by thousands of islands, that is both an advantage and a disadvantage. Keeping the body of the country together in itself is a bit of a problem. So even though you have a number of different ethnicities and religious beliefs all coming together, the truth is also that they are all very compartmentalized in a way by the geography of the country itself. So in this respect, what we've seen, if we look at the trajectory of these past 40 years, the first thing that really strikes you is that the geographic element, in a way, prevented this type of agreement to come around earlier. But at the same time, it sort of contained the problem within specific areas of the country.
Kathleen, you wanted to jump in.
Well, I had a question, actually. It's incredibly interesting. I mean, two things. First of all, the fact that the Aquino dynasty have been with this for decades, and I'm wondering to what extent you think it was actually the current prime minister, but also have the Americans put any pressure on this?
I think you're absolutely right. You're touching upon two very important points. First of all, the family tradition. And I think that looking back, we can't just give it to the current president. I think that this is an issue that has been going on for a very long time within the family. There was an element there of understanding of this long-lasting issue. So for the president, it was something very important. Some say at one level, it was even personal for him to try to tackle it. And of course, his greatest benefit is that he had the popular support to do it. In this respect, I do wonder sometimes the extent to which the game between domestic and foreign policy actually helped him not only consolidate his position. You know, over the past year and a half, we often talked about Aquino's position vis-a-vis China and China's behavior towards the Philippines. In a way, in the face of a greater external threat, that consolidated the sort of middle ground within the Philippines. And in fact, right now, it is said that a December poll tell us that that has got more than 70% support of the population. So that gives you an enormous political capital to attract the problem.
Kathleen, and I'm sure that Alessia will want to jump in this as well. Kathleen, what's interesting for me is when I look at this, you know, so we have the FARC rebels at the moment potentially coming to some agreement with the Colombian government. They've had a dispute that's gone on for 40 years. The Basque separatists, they had terrorism, that they're kind of coming to an agreement there, a bit exhausted it seems, roughly 40 years of campaign. The IRA, it went on for 30-40 years. Do you think that terrorist organisations kind of get exhausted, actually? There has to become a point where the people who are fighting in those groups, you just think, actually, we need our kids to go to school and this needs to come to an end. And even if you haven't won your point, and this is what's happened here, they haven't got a separate country. They've agreed to greater autonomy. Do you think there is an exhaustion element within these organizations sometimes?
I'm very impressed. You've come up with the 40-year principle. In fact, one can use that in various other places. Well, my theory, as it were, is that it's a branch of yours, which is that it's generational. I mean, grandpa may have done it, and then father. And by the time you're in the third generation, you know, you lose the idea of what it's about. And kids go to school, yes, and so forth. But the question is, do I want to die for this? My grandfather did. My father did, sort of. I'm not sure. I mean, the world changes. You now have social media that you didn't have in the earlier times, which means that, you can mobilize different sorts of soft power, I suppose. So perhaps you might divert yourself into other ways of doing it. But the idea that one just gets tired of it, I think that's probably quite a good point.
Alessia.
Absolutely. I think the question, the generational aspect is very important. And I would say that in this context, if we look, the first and second generations tend to be highly motivated. They've got principles, they've got ideas. There is that element, like, it's worth fighting, dying for. I think what is happening, and you know, Kathleen is absolutely right, today we live in a different world altogether. Part of the agreement pointed out that both in terms of tax revenues as well as gains out of metallic minerals that are sold from the area will go to the local population. Now, if you're in the third generation, if you're thinking about the future and you see prospect for a different type of future with some economic advantages to it, right, this will not certainly sort of rally around everybody on the first day, but it does represent an important sort of signal of a possibility to change. There is something at the end of that road that doesn't look like only that sort of ultimate struggle.
You have to come to the point where you think that the best is the enemy of the good. You have to take what, you know, politics, the art of the possible. I mean, how many sound bites would one like here? But at some point, you have to look what you want to do. You have to look at your resources. You have to look at the long road down in front of you and come to a decision. And that seems to have, is what's happened, that the game is no longer worth the candle.
Well, a positive moment, at least for the Philippines. But let's continue with news from somewhere which is still having grave difficulties, Ukraine. The country's former Prime Minister, Yulia Tymoshenko, announced today that she plans to once again run for presidency of Ukraine in the May elections. She promised to build a strong army, and she also said that she hoped to get Crimea back from Russia. At the same time, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has agreed a 14 billion to 18 billion rescue package for the country. This is a significant boost for the Ukrainian government because it is facing intense pressure, of course, from Russia. Again, let's start with you, Kathleen. You know, great that Julia Tymoshenko was released from prison and her years of hunger strike were over, and she was a bit of a darling of the West. But it would be a disaster if she came back. But she seems to represent the past also in many ways for that country, don't you think? They need to choose somebody who in the end is also going to be able to make a peace deal with the Russians one day, at least over gas, trade, some of the basic elements.
Symbolized by her gray hair.
Yes.
She's no longer wholly a blonde. She's only third in the polls as a presidential candidate. The fact that she says she'll get Crimea back immediately puts her in the never-never land, I think. Anyone who has any sense of reality isn't going to support that. Yes, I mean, Russia has raised the price of gas 79%. Which is rather good because it means that the government raising the subsidy off by 50% means that they're going to have someone they can blame. So that was rather a good move, I think, in terms of strategy. She doesn't have a chance. She was a symbol. She was not a terribly good leader. Leaders of the opposition often don't make good leaders of countries because the traits needed, the types of skills needed are very different. And I think she's the darling and she's the doll of the revolution now, but I don't think she's going to be tomorrow's president.
Alessia, again, when you look at her career, you know, and I wonder if this is one of these moments where you kind of almost have some sympathy with the Russian coverage of these events, because we never would countenance anything that she could ever have done wrong. She was, you know, she was held up as this kind of, you know, this kind of goddess figure. But in fact, she did probably make mistakes along the way. And with all of these leaders, there does seem to be, you know, a whiff of excess and corruption in the background, whether that's pinned to her or not, certainly some of the cronies that sat around her. Again, when you look at her candidacy, do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think in principle it is a good thing in the sense that you've got more candidates being lined up for this election. So in that respect, you have to give the fact that Ukraine is looking for a different sort of pathway one way or another. And there's at least three candidates presenting very different sort of profiles altogether. So in that respect, I think it's a good thing. That being said, I completely agree with the point that Kelly was making earlier on about the fact that she does represent the revolution. She does represent change, but in a particular type of format. It's quite interesting that what she was saying about when she announced her candidacy, she pointed out that her agenda would be very much direct, very much looking at the present. You know, right now, I think if I were in Ukraine and I was looking for change, I'd like to see someone who has a vision. And it seems quite intriguing to me that she wasn't really selling a vision, she was selling action, which is a different type of thing. And again, this strikes me as being very much the type of revolutionary talk that was obviously fashionable and relevant 3-4 years ago. But today, I think it falls short of the very big expectation and big challenges for Ukrainian people.
Kathleen.
I mean, one problem about her running, about having so many candidates, there's absolutely no chance then of having a majority government. Mm. And we're going to have to watch a broken country trying to put together a coalition that has enough support. Mm. Now, you could say if you had a majority government, they then have license to do what they want, but they won't have license to do what they want because the IMF will be watching them, the EU will be watching them, the US will be watching them. So in that sense, I would rather, I mean, they're not going to listen to me, sadly, but I would rather that she were not running because she's going to take, you know, 9% that someone else ought to have.
We're going to move on in a second, but Kathleen, just one, and if you can cover this reasonably succinctly, but it seems to me that although she can't, you know, take Crimea back militarily, the way to kind of almost get Crimea back is for Ukraine, what's left of it, to become prosperous, wealthy, westernized, liberal, embracing, and then the Crimeans may think, actually, I'd rather be part of Ukraine. And if this IMF deal works out and this money is, you know, more than a kind of a promise, it's real, is there a chance you think actually, you know, 10 years down the line, if Ukraine is tied to the EU properly, then it could be prosperous and it could pull back in the Crimea that way.
Well, it won't pull it back physically. It could quite well pull it back in terms of wishes and regrets and nostalgia and so forth. The thing is that Russia is going to have to pour jillions into Crimea to make sure the people who have expectations that they're met. Russia doesn't have jillions at this point. They have other places the money could go. So that there will be something really good for the next year, and then Crimea will sort of dribble out of the front row, and then we'll see. And when they discover in Crimea they no longer have full access to social media, that's going to be fun as well.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and Alessio Patilano. When we return, we'll be talking about the global surge in execution numbers.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests today are Alessio Patilano, who's the Professor of War Studies at King's College London, and also Kathleen Burke, who's the Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College in London. Now, we're going to look at the number of executions around the world, because a report today has said that they've risen by 15% in the past year. There were nearly 800 executions globally, and the number rose following a surge, especially in Iraq and Iran. China still remains the biggest executor by far. Amnesty International's report estimates that it executes thousands of its own citizens every single year. But the numbers are treated as a state secret. Alessio, first of all, the huge rise is obviously daunting, and we're all opposed to it. Why do you think that regimes are so reliant on this means of controlling their people? And oddly, it doesn't kind of seem to work. If you have to execute more people every year, it's a clear sign that actually people weren't scared off from doing the very things that you're opposed to.
Well, I think one of the problems is this tension between the elements of deterrence. You know, one of the long-lasting lines about why we use the capital punishment is because that type of choice deters someone else from behaving the same way. But what we've seen is that with these numbers is that the countries that are using the capital punishment the most are actually who do that primarily for political reasons. Because I wouldn't list China, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia on top of the list of the countries that are doing that just to deter the type of behavior. I think there is an element of very centralized forms of government, which does raise the question of the extent to which the use of this tool is not designed to fulfill a sort of political agenda. And certainly this would be the case. And it is interesting, I was looking at the data and I thought it was really interesting insofar as China is concerned, for example, that 2013 was the anti-corruption year in many ways. So there was an important sort of going after the bad boys. So it's interesting to see, but at the same time, it was also the year when you had a number of protests ongoing. So there is a growing sense of political expression. And I do wonder to what extent this data that we're looking at are not also connected to this political problem.
Really. Kathleen.
Well, another question for Alessio. I mean,
he's in the hot seat today.
He's the man who knows about death, obviously. Egypt. Now, saying we're going to execute 589 people tomorrow and then another 500 and whatever the day after, that takes it up an entire new category. Do you think that they're doing it just to instill fear or to wipe away a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood off the earth? What are they trying to do, and do you think it will work?
Well, I think, first of all, we should, in order to answer this question, we should really address the problem of how, I'm thinking here as an East Asian expert, as someone that focuses more on the Far East. And here, the core point, I think, to address is the role of the individual within the community. What is the weight of an individual life? Now, in the West, in Europe, certainly, we have this idea of individualism, you know, the Kantian dualism that emphasizes the person as such, right? So whatever it is that you achieve is essential in terms of how it could affect the community. But in other parts of the world, certainly in other cultures and religions, there is this idea that the best way of the individual to serve the community is to do stuff that in a way, sees its place within communities and harmony, right? So in that respect, numbers become less relevant than the individual life itself, if it is for a greater cause. Certainly, this is idea of how in Chinese law the individual is looked at. You know, it is quite interesting, and even though they use the capital punishment, they also have a system by which they can be particularly lenient if someone shows truthful regret in for what he has done to or she has done to the community. So I think here the fundamental question is one of how we understand the role of the individual within the community, which in a way it's a gateway into the bigger answer, that is, what is the actual meaning?
Alessio, I'm going to have to jump in because we've got maybe two stories, if we can be swift. I'll give maybe one question to each of you on each of these topics. So we're going to go to Egypt, where the Armed Forces Chief and Defence Minister Sedki Sobhi has been sworn in today. Earlier, Egypt's former military chief, Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, rather unsurprisingly announced his resignation as he's going to stand for the presidency. Kathleen, when we look back at all the things that have happened in Egypt, is this just a story of disaster?
Depends on which side you're on. If you're in the Muslim Brotherhood, it is unmitigated disaster.
Well, I think
disaster.
For the West, you know, we meddled, we got involved, and we certainly haven't ended up, you say, 500 people being potentially executed. Nobody in Washington or Paris or London can be rather delighted with the outcome of events, can they?
Well, I think Israel can be, not because of the executions, but because al-Sisi is a new Mubarak, as far as they're concerned. That border is thereby again secured. I presume that the Americans like the idea that Israel is thereby secured. You can predict an authoritarian military leader more than you can predict someone who is responding to pressure from the community as a whole. So I think probably most countries prefer dependable, predictable, solid regimes than ones that they're not sure what's going to happen. That's why Putin is so bad, because not because he's bad in himself, but because no one can predict what he's going to do. Al-Sisi, they can probably predict it.
And on this subject, do you think that his candidacy is a good thing? Or do you think we just kind of ignore Egypt now as a piece of policy that we can't meddle in successfully?
Well, the first thing to say is that when we look at his background, this man has been in the army his entire life. I mean, he was a cadet when he was 15. So I can't really possibly imagine someone who's been that long in the army to be the next big liberal. Certainly, he's going to be a solid choice. And obviously, because he's been there and he's seen what was happening in Egypt during the Arab Spring, he'll probably take note of the importance of creating a better relationship with the sort of wider Egyptian people. That being said, I think I completely agree with Kenlin. We're looking at Mubarak Mark II, which is like an improved version of the previous thing. But you know, in that respect, perhaps is probably a good factor for the wider regional politics. The extent to which this will going to be good for the Egyptian people, I think it still remains to be seen.
Okay, we're going to end with a quirky. I'm not sure. Is it? You can have light stories in this story, but anyway, it is a slightly lighter story because we're going to finish with the news that Ukrainian dolphins, and they're not just any old dolphins, but these are military dolphins which have been trained to detect sea mines and enemy scuba divers. Well, it seems they're defecting to the other side. They're heading to Russia. And Kathleen has a view on this.
Well, it's not a view. It's just I want to point out that this is quite a normal thing. The CIA has run dolphins for decades, in fact. They're used to sniff out secret ships and mines and so forth. The point is that dolphins are pretty. If it was the Ukrainian sharks, people wouldn't mind so much going to Russia. But it's funny in a sense, but it's a weapon of war is being taken over by the Russians that used to belong to the Ukrainians. If you look at it that way, it's one more knockout of Ukrainian self-defense force.
Alessia, do you have any opinions on dolphins?
I like them. Okay. I think they're nice, although I tend to prefer sharks. You know, they've got more persona and character.
And teeth.
And teeth.
We also did a story once, I think, about Colombia, where they've trained rats to be mine detectors. Sadly, not many of them came back from their missions, though. Alessio Patilano and Kathleen Burke, thank you, as always, for joining me here on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Isto é Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Mônaco, vai a City Cheche.
From London,
London. London, caralho.
This is Mônaco 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to speak to a Finnish director who's made a film of his efforts to find a balance between which possessions he actually needs and values and what is rather unnecessary clutter. We'll also speak to our woman in Brussels and we'll get this week's book recommendations from France. But before we get started on that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
New satellite images from the southern Indian Ocean suggest that up to 300 objects are floating in the water where it's thought the missing Malaysia Airways plane was lost. The air operation searching the ocean had to be suspended earlier because of bad weather, but a number of ships have continued looking for debris. Rescue workers in the US state of Washington say the number of deaths after a devastating landslide will increase substantially in the next 48 hours. 24 people are confirmed dead after the mudslide hit the town of Oso, 55 miles north of Seattle, but another 90 are still missing. After 13 years of negotiations, the government in the Philippines has signed an agreement with the country's largest Muslim rebel group. It's thought that more than 120,000 people died in more than four decades of fighting linked to demands for independence for the southern Philippines. The International Monetary Fund will lend Ukraine up to $18 billion. It's part of a total package worth $27 billion. Meanwhile, Ukraine's former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has confirmed she plans to stand for president in elections in May. And a new head has been appointed for Egypt's armed forces. General Sedki Sobhi was sworn in the day after his predecessor, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, resigned so that he could stand for president. Mr. Sisi was reportedly at the cabinet meeting where his successor was chosen. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul, and welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We continue with a check-in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we get the latest discussion topics from Brussels. Joining me on the line is Monocle's correspondent there, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson. Charlotte, thank you for coming on the show. Well, we know what the big news is because President Obama has obviously been in Brussels talking to the EU about the crisis in Russia and the Crimea. How welcome was he?
Well, yes, it's a pretty big visit for Brussels because ever since taking office, which was quite a few years ago, President Obama has so far managed to avoid visiting the capital of the European Union. So there was some grumbles at this snub in the past. So EU officials were very keen to stress the huge symbolism of the fact that he was here and the fact that he was here now during this crisis between Russia, Europe, and America, and stressing that this unity between the EU and the US was crucial at this time. So that was one of the key topics, but we've also got to remember that this year hasn't exactly been a particularly positive one for American-European relations, in particular because of these spying allegations, the allegations that the NSA not only tapped phones of European leaders like Angela Merkel, but ordinary citizens, their phone records, their social media. So this was somewhat hanging over the visit, but in a way the Ukraine dominated so much, it didn't get the attention that it might have done otherwise.
Now, Charlotte, some of the more details that came out of the story, there were a few faux pas, one of which was a local newspaper depicted the president as a monkey. How does that happen in this day and age?
Well, that was exactly the question that people were asking themselves. Now, the newspaper, which is a daily newspaper, they claimed it was satire. It was part of quite a convoluted satire story about how this was a photograph that Vladimir Putin had sent the paper. But that didn't really wash, and it really did create a debate about how, as you said, in this day and age, that sort of apparent racism can make it onto the page of a newspaper. Now, as I said, they claimed satire, but that didn't work, and in the end, they did have to apologise for what they admitted was a tasteless joke.
And tell me, it seems that the president could have kind of slightly cheered himself up with having a rather interesting biscuit.
Yes, exactly. Obama did mention during his keynote speech at an arts institute last night that he was a big fan of Belgian beer and chocolate, which of course are the country's two most famous consumables, but that wasn't what he received. He was gifted with a life-size gingerbread version of himself in basketball kit. Yes, I've seen the picture and it's quite frightening.
So he can literally say, eat my shorts after being given that, I guess.
He could, but apparently secret security have to destroy the biscuit in case of poisoning. So I don't think anyone will be eating his shorts for that.
And finally, on the faux pas front, even the king managed to kind of fluff his lines.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a bit of a favourite of mine because it was a very solemn speech, obviously, when Obama and the Belgian Prime Minister, Leonardo Ripo, and King Philippe went to Flanders Fields, which is obviously a key World War One battle site. When he stood there and gave his speech, there was something a bit off, and I'm going to quote now. He spoke of the horrors of the French warfare, including the use of chemical weapons for the first time ever, and thereby accusing one of their World War One allies of some quite horrendous crimes. Luckily, the US Embassy put out a press release pretty swiftly, insisting that King Philippe had in fact said trench warfare, not French warfare. Although I have to say, I've listened to the recording and he did say French warfare, so it still remains a bit of a mystery whether or not that was a typo in the speech he was reading or a bit of a fumble with English.
It's a good job that President Obama doesn't visit Brussels too often, it seems. Now, on a more important issue in many ways, Belgium is about to pass a law in the coming month which will ban all sexism. How is this going to work, and what's the background to this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an important issue because it is something that women face on the streets all around the globe, and whether it's wolf whistles or cat calls or more aggressive behaviour. And in the UK as well, there's been this debate over trolling on the internet with prominent female figures and people espousing feminist views in particular coming in for really quite appalling comments on Twitter. So Belgium looks set to become the first country in the world to actually outlaw this sort of form of sexism. And this has been making the headlines, first of all, because it's such an interesting and debated topic, but secondly, because there are concerns in some legal quarters that the language is going to be so vague that it could end up as an attack on all sorts of free speech, including, for example, rappers or hip-hop artists, which occasionally do use some derogatory terms for women in their lyrics. And they've also said that feminists could come in for some problems under this new law if they make comments about men as a group. So it really has, it sparked a debate about what the best way really is to tackle this sort of harassment.
But is there a sense, finally, Charlotte, that this is meant to be aimed at the kind of aggressive language that might be used on the street rather than what appears in novels or in song lyrics?
Well, that's it. I think this is what they were targeting. It came after a documentary by a woman in Brussels who filmed the sort of everyday comments she received on the street. So the motives behind it, they're good motives, but as I said, the legal experts worry that the wording is just so vague that even if that's what it's aimed at, it could be interpreted and used by certain groups to really go against other groups which really wouldn't come under this law, what the law was originally intended for.
Can I just ask you one thing? Is there another contentious element to this? Because I've seen some of these films that have been done and they seem to kind of draw out comments, particularly in some Muslim communities from some Muslim men who don't like seeing women scantily dressed or behaving in certain ways. Is that part of the debate in Belgium as well about these comments?
It isn't at the moment regarding this law, but it was at the time that this particular documentary came out. I think it was in 2011. And certainly there was some accusations that the Muslim community was targeted and that they were unfairly represented in this documentary. But I think it's important to look at what happened in Britain as well with the trolling on Twitter and things and those sort of comments aimed at women. And that was nothing to do with any particular community or any particular religion. It was across the board. So I don't think there's any suggestion that this is purely a problem for one community.
Well, Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us. That was, of course, Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, who's our woman in Brussels. And you're listening to Midori House. It is indeed Midori House, and it's currently 18:40 here in London, which means it's 20:40 in Istanbul and 21:40 in Nairobi. Now, have you got too much stuff? Well, you should listen to this then, because you really get a finished documentary film that makes it to the international market. But the most talked about documentary in the country last year, My Stuff, has now succeeded where others have failed. This followed it getting rave reviews in its home country. The documentary is about an experiment undertaken by the director, Petri Luukkainen. He took every single possession out of his apartment, put it into storage and allowed himself to bring one item back per day over the period of 12 months. This way, he was hoping to learn more about his attitude to his possessions, to learn to draw a line between what he really needs and values and what is simply unnecessary clutter. Petri Luukkainen met Monocle's Marcus Hippie in Midori House and told him about the start of this project.
Well, I started the whole experiment in January in Finland, in Helsinki, and it was some like minus 30 degrees out there. So, of course, the first items were, you know, dictated by the weather. You know, I, you know, wanted to take some clothes. So, and, you know, at some point, I think I took a mattress. You know, I think I slept like 5 days on the floor or something. So,
in every case, it is obvious that it wasn't very comfortable for you. What was it actually made you want to go through this kind of misery in order to make this documentary?
Well, this was not something that was kind of really like a planned, this was not like a planned experiment or it was totally not like a planned film production or anything. I've been kind of thinking it was just like kind of like, you know, cut your hair in a radical way. And somebody would ask you like, why did you cut your hair? And you just, well, I just felt like it. And I have this kind of same kind of idea when I kind of remember that I was, you know, not really happy about my life, maybe. I was in my apartment that was basically like full of everything.
Some people normally take a holiday in that situation or something.
Yeah, I think that might be it. But when I was kind of looking around, I think I kind of felt that, okay, I have some problem with this stuff. You know, I want to, you know, solve my, you know, everyday life in some sense. And
Did you think of getting a cleaner?
Somehow I just had the idea that if I could transport the item somewhere else, you know, then I would have, you know, some space to things. Then I could actually do something, not just think about it. So that's how it kind of started. And of course, in the beginning, the first idea was not to, you know, take everything, start naked. I just thought that I would just transport them somewhere else. I started packing. Then I had the idea of, if I'm going to do this kind of lifestyle change, should I kind of also, I could maybe actually do a documentary about it, because I've been doing quite a lot of diary and video diary. But that was just for myself in a way. It was not as a film production. And then when I started packing, I was thinking I would leave 1,000 items or something. That was my initial idea. And then I kind of realized that when I was starting to think what will be the items that I will leave, I understood that actually the process in itself and the things that I'm going to leave, that's going to be the interesting. So I wanted to prolong the process in a way. So that's why I kind of started to figure out these rules, like, will I take everything and how much, could I kind of start naked? And and that's how it kind of went.
What did you learn about yourself during that process? And what were the biggest challenges?
I think somewhere in the process, I kind of learned that actually the stuff that I'm now getting back one by one, it's not probably going to change my life, you know, or my personality too much. So I think I was, at the time, I was quite ashamed of the thing that I've actually been really interested in my belongings. And, you know, was I thinking that these things are actually going to make me like super happy? Or, you know, or would you like look into the mirror and say like, yeah, I am my stuff? In a way, like, why have I been interested in, let's say, building myself or building my life from these items that I own? Like, and maybe what's up? Have I been missing something else? And I'm also filming it.
Did you learn something about the value of quality when it comes to items versus items that are basically just clutter?
I think I value the things that I have nowadays more. I think if I think my problem was that I had too much of everything, that was because I wasn't, you know, thinking about the things I was buying. I was really not, you know, giving a shit about the things that I'm getting in. And so I was kind of reckless. So now I've been really trying to value the items that I have. Or if I would, you know, to buy something new, I would really kind of give it some thought in a way. And I may I might be even more materialistic nowadays. And I think all the things that you have that normally maybe you get them to make your life easier or, you know, help you in a way. All these items, they take a lot of energy from you because you have to give them energy. And I think nowadays I want to choose where I give my energy out to and not have like million things that everything's going to take my energy from.
I reckon that you actually didn't take everything out from your storage and bring it back to your flat.
I think my official answer would be, for example, if you would stop drinking alcohol or if you're like a heavy smoker and then you're having this like 1 year without smoking, in the end, would you just snap back to the beginning? And so no, I didn't snap back to the beginning and get all the items back that I...
Do you feel like you had a clearer mindset then when you didn't have so much clutter and so many items in your house?
Well, as you mentioned, many people, you know, in that kind of situation that I was, you know, anxiety at my home, they take a vacation. I kind of tried to take it as a vacation within my flat and or this kind of, let's say, self-searching trip that I would go to India for 3 months. I just kind of did that experiment within my flat. And in the beginning, yeah, in a way, it was kind of calm. It was like a retreat. You know, I was basically locked into my apartment. I was there like half naked for a week or something. At some point, it got really dull. And when you don't have all these kind of things ripping you apart, like TV, radio, you know, iPad, iPhone, internet, when you don't have these things, it kind of forces you to think. And it's actually not so quite heavy in the beginning because you don't have anything to do. You cannot entertain yourself in any way, basically.
And what's quite remarkable is that Petri Luukkainen, and you have directed this film that actually is going to get into international distribution. And actually, that's one of the reasons why you're visiting London as well. This film is going to be seen in 15 countries, at least, over the globe. How easy is it actually to achieve something like this coming from Finland, making a film in Finnish for Finnish market to start with?
I don't think many, even Finnish films, I don't think many documentaries, it doesn't matter in which country they're from, get a lot of distribution in, you know, countries, you know, beside their own market. But I think the idea in the film, it's some existential way or some deeper level, it touches many of us, you know, like I think we kind of express ourselves with the items that we have. And I think that kind of makes us human. So somehow it interests many people that even though it's a kind of a Finnish documentary art house spoken in Finnish, that distributors around the world think that, this is so interesting that actually we think that we can have people going to cinema to see it. So I think just the idea is in a way somewhat universal, that it kind of just kind of sells itself. I don't know. I mean, we're not professional salesmen, you know, or distributors. I mean, we just did a film with my friends and now everybody's excited about it and we're overwhelmed.
Oh, so many questions and so few answers. An excellent interview there. I want to know, one, did he allow himself to have a toilet roll and a tissue and maybe a toothbrush at the beginning? I'm worried. Two, second question is, Marcus Hippie, who did that, apparently he said he'd take his hair gel. That would be the first thing that he would take out of storage. Secondly, a brush. And I can believe that as well. And thirdly, if you want to know more about Finland, I suggest you go to YouTube and you type in Magic for Dogs, because then you will find out what Finnish people are truly like. Anyway, that was Petri Luukkainen, who's the director of the Finnish documentary My Staff, which is going to be distributed around the world. So you can find out whether he did start off butt naked or not. But now it's time for a bit of music. We just heard from a Finnish director. Gosh, I think the show's sponsored by the Finnish Tourist Board. Let's stay on track with Finnish music. This is Suvi with Bleeding for Your Love. Well, that was music from Finland. That was Suvi with Bleeding for Your Love. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where we continue with our daily review segment, where we go through the best in film, theatre, music and television and books. Because today we're going to talk literature, French literature to be more precise. One of France's major book fairs, Le Salon du Livre, has just ended in Paris. And joining me from the French capital is Charlotte Podlowski, who's the culture editor of Slate France. Charlotte, thanks very much for coming on the show. And I know you're going to talk about three books who made some noise here at the salon. And could you tell us about the first book?
Yes, the first book is En finir avec Eddie Bellegueule, Being Through with Eddie Bellegueule. And this is the novel everybody has been talking about for the past few weeks. It has all the ingredients for a controversy. It is a true story. The writer is 22 years old and has already written a book about Pierre Bourdieu, who is a famous French sociologist, and he comes from a very poor background where he was relentlessly bullied for being gay, and that's the story he tells in the book. And he writes about his family, his parents, who were mocking him for being too effeminate, about his efforts to fit in, to be, quote-unquote, a real man. And there are vivid episodes of violence in the book, such as two kids spitting on him because he's gay and making him eat it, or when his heterosexual male friends and even his own cousin, lacking sexual experience and female company, they decide to try sodomy out of boredom and they try it on him. And whereas for them it is somewhat casual, for the hero it is torture because he actually enjoys it and he starts acknowledging his own sexuality and he is deathly afraid of the consequences of being gay, because being gay is about as low as you could be in his hometown.
Now tell me, this book has, you know, been controversial in France, it's been in the headlines, it's made lots of waves. What is the reason for that? Is it because of his brutal honesty about his own family? Is it their response? Or is it a society response? Is it a response that the, you know, French society felt that it was actually, you know, kind of embracing of people's differences and found out that perhaps it's not?
Well, you know, I think both reasons are can explain why the book has been such a huge thing in France. Because first, there is the fact that, you know, we've had this whole debate about gay marriage last year in France, and it has been a very complicated year, ideologically speaking, and people were very divided, and they still are. And this book is saying, hey, you have to know, it is that violent when you are gay in some parts of the country, and people are that homophobic and archaic. But I think what you say about people, you know, finding it hurtful that he talks about his family like that and that he is so cruel about them is also something that people, you know, they rejected it because they, some book critics even said that he was betraying his family, that he was scornful, contemptuous. And I think it's, you know, some people in France have a very idealized way of, idealized vision of what poor people should be or what they think poor people are, and some book critics thought that the vision that the book was giving was not the one they had, was not the one they wanted to have.
Now we've got only a little bit of time left, and I want to get quickly through the other two books. Le Sceau de Requin, if I haven't killed that too much, just tell me about the book.
Yeah, le saut du requin, you know, it means the shark's jump, which is an English expression.
Yeah, to jump the shark, we say.
Yeah, yes, that's the one. And so the story of the book is this, it's about two lovers who are Ziggy and Melin, and they meet online and they get involved because she is too, you know, she thinks he's very handsome and she's very lucky to have him, whereas he's a very, very selfish guy. But, you know, to talk about the title, because I think it's very interesting that this book, which is about a fascinating love story, just can't, you know, find its way to be a very interesting book. And I think it's because it lies too much on its American references. And I think many novelists in France, many young writers are too obsessed with American references, and they can't find a way to build their own style using those references and digesting them.
Charlotte, we've almost run out of time. This is a challenge. 10, 15 seconds. Just tell me about La Petite Foule. Good, bad? give me a line why we should read it. You've got 20 seconds.
Well, it is the best we can do dealing with Raymond Carver in France.
Okay. Look at that. You are a genius. You'll be back on the show in no time. Charlotte, thank you so much. That was, of course, Charlotte Podlowski, who's the culture editor of Slate France and a genius with her timing as well. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Kathleen Burke and Alessio Patilano. And of course, to Charlotte Podlowski there. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Sarah Funier. And our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next after news is The Urbanist, a damn fine show where I'll be looking at freedom in the city. From feeling free to express your faith in Nazareth to the tightening of rules in Amsterdam, a city renowned for its liberal culture.
You can roll your joint and smoke it on the streets, you know, if you're a bit discreet. That's a very liberal feeling, of course, you know, and because of that liberal feeling, people think that everything is possible, maybe. But that is not how it is.
Then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.